everyone, and welcome to Reverb. My name is Calvin Pollock, and I'm joined once again by my co-host and co-producer, Alex Hellberg. Hey, Alex.
Hey there, Calvin.
And we are so stoked to be joined once again, fan favorite, co-host, co-producer, Olivia Burnett. Welcome back, Olivia.
Hi, Calvin. Glad to be back.
This is so fun. And what's so fun about this episode is we are inaugurating a new style of episode. This is the style of episode that I came up with, taking full credit, which is called Reelverb. That's R-E-E-L colon V-E-R-B, because we're talking about a movie this episode. And we're hoping to do a few more of these going forward. But this time, we're talking about a brand new movie, the political thriller Civil War, directed by Alex Garland. So you both excited to talk about Civil War?
Absolutely. I mean, I got to say, I feel like this segment, I mean, even though, yes, I will give Calvin full credit for inventing the name and the series idea. I think we were all inspired by the last episode we did together with Scott Adams, where he talked about watching movies playing in our heads. We were all so inspired. We had to go out and we were all in movie mode. So, I mean, I think that's really what's gotten me so psyched to be here with you two today.
Yeah. How about you, Olivia? Are you excited?
I just don't understand why Iron Man and Captain America were fighting so much. I mean, they're on the same.
Oh, no.
They're all on the Avengers, so.
You watched the wrong Civil War.
We got to go back and regroup, back to the drawing board.
Oh, no, this isn't going to work. No, I actually had that same thought. Like, wasn't there another Civil War several years ago? And we might have even talked about it in our episode with Kendall Phillips, Alex.
We may have. I think we did, actually. I think that was in one of his more recent books that we talked about, where he did the analysis of the Avengers cinematic universe. But this time we're talking about a more realistic war this time. It's not fantasy anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into it. So I mean, the first thing that I wanted to do here is just to kind of set the terms of how we all felt about this movie. My idea was, let's come up with our own rating system. Reverb rating system. And that rating system is going to be a score out of 5 verbs. So, you know, a masterpiece like Citizen Kane probably gets 5 out of 5 verbs. And we could come up with 5 important actions that characters undertake in that film, or perhaps, you know, that go on in the world of that film. And so I'll start us off. For me, Civil War, directed by Alex Garland, I didn't love it. I would give it 2 verbs out of 5. And for me, the 2 verbs that really characterize this movie are very banal verbs. They are drive and observe. To me, this movie was primarily just the characters driving and then observing things happening. And I found it really alienating and boring for the most part. So that's my take. Alex, would you like to give us your rating next?
Absolutely. I mean, first, I just have to say, like, you know, brilliant job in your analysis, giving 2 verbs that kind of cued for me better movies. So first of all, drive, the Ryan Gosling breakout hit, and then observe, the first half of Observe and Report, a great low-key screwball comedy.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I thought of making my 2 verbs observe and report, but there's no actual reporting in this, despite the fact that the movie is about journalists. They do no reporting.
We get one piece of evidence at the beginning that Kirsten Dunst is in fact filing some of her photos for story. But other than that, you're right. We don't get any reporting. So my ratings, I would say I also had some heavy skepticism towards this movie, both going in and now coming out of it. I have kind of gone on an emotional roller coaster in the way that I've felt about this, but I would have to give this one 3 verbs. And my 3 verbs, I decided to make them rhyme just for the heck of it. My 3 verbs are spectate, investigate, refusal to participate. Which I guess refusal is a nominalization, but you'll have to give that one to me. I embedded one more action in there than I really gave it credit for.
Jeez, I didn't know we were doing slam poetry on this ep, but I love it. Olivia, let's hear your rating.
Will you permit me, Gerunds?
Oh yeah, gerunds are fine. They're derived from verbs, so that's fine.
My thought is, I love every movie that I've ever seen. First of all, because I just enjoy watching movies, and second of
Scott
all,
Adams.
Yes, much like Scott Adams, I'm just watching a movie inside my head that is a lot better than the movie that is happening on the screen, so I love every movie. And I will also preface this by saying I have been trying to watch my way through Adam Sandler's filmography to get through finals. So I thought this was a pretty decent movie. I'm going to give it three verbs: shooting, screaming, and sweating.
Ooh,
absolutely
provocative.
Yes, a lot of those happen in this movie. So I do think that just to orient ourselves, and you know, I'm sure as we talk through this, we're going to understand more some of our disagreements about what worked and what didn't work in this movie. But just to set the terms of our analysis, I thought it could be helpful to walk through a summary of the plot. This is also great because something that a lot of people like to do now is not actually see or watch things, but just read and listen to commentary on them. So we can provide that to listeners who don't really want to see this movie, but want to know basically what happens in it. And so we can kind of tag team this. Alex wrote up a great plot summary for us. So do you want to start us off, Alex?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. So we open in this movie with somebody who I was so bummed because I thought we were going to see more of him. I would have loved to see more of him. So we start out with clean-shaven Nick Offerman preparing and sort of stutteringly giving a speech about how victory is close at hand for the American government against the rebellious sort of terrorist forces that we are introduced to as besieging the, you know, the true American Union. And of course, he is, you know, kind of giving practice runs at this. And we're meant to assume, I guess, that, you know, even though he is claiming with utmost certainty that victory is close at hand, that actually he is not quite certain about that. He's speaking with trepidation and a little bit of nerves. We then cut into the main sort of exposition point in New York City, where the main character, Lee Kirsten Dunst, her partner Joel, played by Wagner Moura, are out observing a street protest in New York City, where we first meet Jessie. I don't know, what did you guys think of Jessie when she first popped onto the scene here?
I mean, Jessie is clearly a younger participant in this action that's going on. And it's important to note that this is a protest by all accounts, a violent protest at some kind of water distribution center. That was as best I could understand from what was going on. And Jessie is taking photos of what's going on, but in a very unsafe way. And Lee, this older photojournalist, kind of intervenes and gives her a bulletproof vest, right?
I think it's not even, no, she says, next time I want to see you in Kevlar. The thing that she just gives her is the fluorescent yellow press vest. So again, it's supposed to be, you know, the thing that protects you is just the fact that you are labeled as a journalist. That's kind of the first sense that we get of how journalism is going to be rendered here, that these are the people in fluorescent vests who are down there to document, even as a suicide bomber runs into the crowd and blows it up. So as a result, she kind of gets rescued from that. Jessie now believes that she is in Lee's debt, or is, you know, this kind of person that she is looking up to. So we cut over to that evening in their hotel, where they meet up with their friend Sammy, played by Stephen McKinley Henderson, classic
Great actor
from a whole bunch of different roles. You saw him most recently in the Dune franchise, I believe, as well as Lady Bird, a whole bunch of other great roles.
Fantastic in Beau is Afraid, by the way.
Ooh, I haven't seen that one yet, but
highly
I'm excited
recommend
for that. So they all start sharing some secrets about what are they trying to do next. We learn that Lee and Joel, their primary goal is to find a way to get to D.C. So that they can interview and photograph the president. Now, why exactly they want to do that, other than the kind of obvious, you know, he's beset in the midst of the Civil War, we are not exactly privy to. Sammy at first regards it as kind of a suicide mission, but of course we also get the sense that they are more or less kind of, you know, at first they're kind of playfully joking about how they're going to poach one another's ideas, but they decide that they are all going to, Lee sneaks off to try and upload her photos, and Joel recruits both Sammy and Jessie to join them on the tour.
And my understanding too is that Sammy, the older reporter, was interested in the front of the war that was taking place in Charlottesville. And because of this sort of circuitous route that they have to take to get to DC, kind of works out that Sammy is able to see the, you know, the area of the fighting that's presumably going on there on the way to their goal of getting to DC. And so then it basically shifts. Oh, yeah. Sorry. And we should mention that Jesse shows up at the hotel, as you mentioned, this younger journalist or photographer who believes she's in debt to Lee, Kirsten Dunst's character. And she basically finds a way to latch on to their road trip. And by the next day, they're on the road setting out for DC.
Yeah. And the first stop, they make several stops here that we'll kind of breeze through a little bit, because like Calvin said, there's a lot of driving and a lot of observing that takes place in this movie with a couple of stops. The first stop that they get is at a gas station where that is being held up, or I guess run by some paramilitary guys, just guys dressed like kind of stereotypical rural
militia
with assault rifles.
And we get no sense of what side they're on.
Yes. Yeah. This is going to be a theme that recurs throughout our telling of this, is that we don't really get a sense of who any of these people are with. Most of them are not wearing uniforms that really specifically designate them as one side or another. And in fact, I was kind of confused at the fact that they, upon release, I think there was a map that A24 published on their social media feeds that showed all of the different factions in the war. And I think there was only like one that was actually mentioned, or maybe two, I guess. There was the California-Texas coalition and the Western forces, which is like the vast majority of the American North, South, and Midwest.
In the movie, there's also a reference to a Florida formation of some sort.
Yes.
I think the Western forces are Texas and California.
That's what I thought too.
Florida has united, like the South will rise again type thing.
Right. So the Western forces include Texas and California, and Florida is an ally of the Western forces against DC.
Yeah. So at this gas station with the unnamed militia members, we find out Jesse goes kind of touring around the back of the building and discovers that they are in the hollowed out car wash of this gas station. They are basically doing Abu Ghraib stuff to some other, I guess, presumably enemy combatants. Just two men are hanging in the car wash with basically, you know, their, you know, gunshots in them, you know, cut up and things like that. Basically being left to die, and Jesse freezes. She cannot photograph them, even though that's kind of what she initially went back there to do.
I just want to mark something. So the gas station scene happens, and they're back in the car, kind of reacting to what has just happened. And Jesse is upset. She's like crying. And this is a moment where the other characters say, like, oh no, we shouldn't have brought her with us. There's this kind of moral dilemma that they start to face of, we brought a younger person, an inexperienced reporter with us, and she's really reacting emotionally to this. But the sense that I got is that Jesse is really upset that she didn't get any pictures. She's not actually upset about the human misery that she just witnessed. Right.
No, I think that's incredibly important to note, because the next scene is one that I like to refer to as JCPenney Black Hawk Down. It's one that you probably have seen cited elsewhere on social media. It's one that a few people were kind of making fun of. I actually, upon first viewing, I thought it was kind of poignant to see a literal, like a Black Hawk helicopter that had gotten, I guess it looked like, entangled in some power lines and downed in the parking lot of a JCPenney next to a mega mall that, you know, kind of is representative of American suburbia.
Yeah. So, and I think this part of their route is supposed to be near Pittsburgh. And it reminded me a lot of Monroeville, which is like a suburb of Pittsburgh. That's
where my wife is from. Yes, it does. Yeah. It reminds me a lot of Monroeville.
That has a big mall. And it's where George A. Romero shot Dawn of the Dead. And so it's a very poignant kind of like shitty dead American mall. So I liked the aesthetic of that scene.
I agree. And I think that it was, you know, poignant that this was the place where Lee decides that Jesse can sort of like, you know, sharpen her teeth a little bit, trying to photograph war scenes that are still, that don't have any people in them. It's here that we hear that, you know, Jesse's family is back on a farm in Missouri, I believe, trying to pretend that the war is not happening. So Jesse is kind of out here because she wants to be where the action is, and of course to photograph it. So the next, we get another more sort of live action photo shoot. Now that Jessie has kind of gotten her confidence up, have this fight scene that takes place in this kind of unnamed area between like some militia members, some ostensible loyalists to the US government. Again, we don't really get a marking of who is fighting here. Like,
it's just literally like a level in Halo is what it feels like. Like, it's just like a bombed out building and there's two forces shooting at each other.
Yes. If you play a lot of Call of Duty, scenes like this will be very familiar to you.
Call of Duty has better world building than this. This is like, it's blank. Like, it really feels like a Halo or like a, you know, in my opinion, like an Xbox level, in part because there's so little detail. It's just sort of destroyed building and army guys shooting at each other within it.
Yes. Yep. So here is where we see Jessie actually starting to really cut her teeth on getting good war photographs. And we get a lot of the cinematography here is sort of like seeing these kinetic action scenes and then just getting a, you know, that photo, that camera sound or the shutter stop with a black and white, you know, like war photo, like classic war photograph kind of vignette in for something that's happening that's very well composed and very well shot on the screen.
Yeah. And that becomes a big aesthetic motif in this film is super intense violence being interrupted by these still photos, these still black and white photos being taken by Jessie and Lee throughout the action. But yeah, this is, you know, to me, other than the first scene with the suicide bombing, this is when the violence in this movie really starts to get kicked up to an extreme level where you're seeing just extremely brutal, you know, shootings and mutilations up close that Jessie and Lee and Joel are following right behind and documenting to no seeming purpose, but we'll get there later.
Yes. Yeah. I'm realizing now that I did miss something that comes up in the next beat here, which is one that I was confused as to whether or not this was supposed to be Pittsburgh, where after they spend the night after this first fighting scene in a refugee camp in a stadium, they stop by a town where seemingly everyone is just pretending that the war is not happening, that it is not actually in existence. And I wanted to kind of get everybody's take on this scene where this person, you know, or they go into this boutique town where, you know, seemingly nothing is happening. And the woman behind the counter is just like, hey, look around. Let me know if you need anything or whatever. And they're like, you know that there's a war going on out there, right? And she says,
and she's
this
like,
thing,
we don't get involved. Is that what she says?
Yeah, she says, from what we've seen on the news, we figure it's probably best to stay out of it. That is, I think, a loose paraphrase of the line.
Right. And then crucially, we see them step foot out of this store and there are gunmen on the tops of buildings around them, like keeping them fully in sight. And it's, again, not clear what side those gunmen are on, but it's obvious that there is a level of base violence like operating in the background, despite the fact that they're pretending it's not there. But yeah, this is a very sort of like, it's a moment for Lee and Jessie to like try on clothes and sort of have a brief respite. And Joel as well kind of like flirts with the clerk, because one thing we learn is that Joel is extremely horny and he hits on Jessie. That's like the one thing we learn about Joel, is that he kind of wants to get with the younger reporter who they're taking around. And yeah, and that's kind of the main purpose of this scene, I guess, is to show that there are people in America who are pretending this is not really happening, even though there's violence literally on the rooftops around them.
I feel that the like shot in the dark at character development with the Lee is trying on a dress at the behest of Jessie. He's like, no, you'll look beautiful. And she looks in the mirror, Kirsten Dunst as Lee, and is like, I don't even recognize myself. It's been days since I've looked in the mirror. That really killed me. And it was also a really ugly dress. It was
super
bizarre.
Ugly. Yeah, that was a strange scene for a lot of reasons. And yeah, as you're saying, it felt like a shot in the dark at some kind of character development, building out this relationship, but they didn't really say much to each other.
Yeah. I don't know if Alex Garland was like, what do women do for fun? Women
they
be
like
shopping.
To look at themselves in the mirror.
Women be shopping. Men be hitting on women who are trying to shop.
I just want to pause here really quick because I think it's important to note that, Olivia, that there's that scene of Kirsten Dunst's Lee character in that sort of like the triptych mirror there in the shop that actually mirrors another scene, a very famous one from Alex Garland's Ex Machina from 10 years ago, where the rogue AI fembot that kind of escapes the laboratory looks at herself in a triptych or tripartite mirror for the first time ever. And that's sort of like when she gains this sense of like, I am myself and now I must go and wreak hell on the world. So I did note that. I think I haven't really paid that close of attention to his other movies, but that seems to be a recurring theme for women in Alex Garland movies. They're always in mirrors.
And they're always like becoming self-aware. Suddenly.
Yes, they're always becoming self-aware.
They weren't
mirrors.
Self-aware before that.
It's sort of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like on the bottom, we have like women be shopping. On top of that, perhaps self-awareness. And then at the top of the pyramid, like world domination.
That's absolutely right.
So then after the women be shopping scene, for lack of a better summarizing phrase, we end up in a refugee camp at a kind of decommissioned, seemingly high school sports stadium. And
it's sort of like share a Coke with political refugees. Everyone was sort of like warming their hands around the fire, playing card games, like hula hooping. It was
basically Coachella. I mean, that's kind of what
it
looked
was
like.
More,
yeah,
like
yeah.
They had the porta
yeah, or like
pies.
A farmer's market, like a farmer's market. I mean, it reminded me of the farmer's market we would have here in Seattle. And you know, there's food being shared. There are clearly some places for people to sleep. And like any refugee camp, it's a refuge from the fighting around. But an important part of this scene is that Jesse is sitting in the bleachers of the stadium and developing her film, and Lee brings her some food and they have their first real conversation, I would say, like a slightly extended conversation where Jesse wants to learn more about Lee. And perhaps the most cringe line in the movie to me, Jesse says, you know, I first discovered you or learned about you from your photos of the Antifa massacre.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Which the Antifa massacre is just put in there like very pointedly. And of course, and this is something that critics who have praised the film have praised it for, it's intentionally ambiguous whether Antifa activists were massacred or did the massacring. That, you know, that's not clarified at all. It's just referred to by that slogan, the Antifa massacre. But then Jesse tries to probe, like, how did you get into photography or more about her life? And Lee basically says nothing that stuck with me. And so I found that scene really disappointing from a character development standpoint, where it was a perfect opportunity to learn more about their motivations and honestly their politics and their morality. And we got nothing out of it.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that I would have to say to that is, like, first of all, I mean, good job, movie. This is the first scene where you pass the Bechdel test, I think. I wasn't paying attention as to whether or not they were talking or any men were brought up in the conversation, but it certainly was not the sort of focus. So, I mean, again, good job, at least on that, Alex Garland. But at the same time, you're right, Calvin. They don't do a lot of character development. The only thing that I would say to the reference to the Antifa massacre, the other reason, one of the other things that this movie has gotten kind of scorned for, is that if you stayed far enough into the credits to see the acknowledgments, you will know that some of the opening footage, I forgot to mention this, superimposed on the president's speech is this sort of like social media cell phone footage taken from various ostensible riots, protests, whatever, that are supposed to be the sort of onset of the Civil War. Many of those were sourced from well-known right-wing provocateur of social media, Andy Ngo. So, I mean, there's conspicuous evidence in here that, like, you know, that even if Alex Garland, and we're going to get into this, has a kind of like incoherent politics of this movie, there are clearly some voices that he's willing to listen to as authoritative on this topic that are maybe a little bit suspect.
Right. And Andy Ngo, just for people who aren't familiar, is a right-wing provocateur who loves to clip videos of protests and make left-wing protesters look bad. He played a huge role in getting various people canceled and fired and harassed during 2020 Black Lives Matter protests. And he's just sort of like a known propagandist for the far right.
Yeah, known for conflating, you know, like principled activists who have like real sort of like material demands and motivations as just being these kind of chaos agents who are looking to sow discord and anarchy and destruction of property. It's kind of, yeah, and he's the one who posts scary videos on social media that are meant to tar left-wing movements. So beyond this, next we have the Christmas Fair sniper duel, where the gang, the press gang, is driving their press vehicle with press on the side. We get a lot of just demarcations of the characters. It's like, by the way, they're journalists, like kind of beaten into us at every single turn in this movie. They come across this very strange, although I would say if you've been anywhere in like suburban America, these kinds of things are all over the place. A drive-through Christmas lights fair that you can stay in your car during the winter and just observe all of the, you know, like Christmas decorations, polar bears, Santa Claus. I think there was maybe
inflatables.
A nativity. Was there a nativity scene or was that a Santa's workshop?
I think it was a Santa's workshop. Okay. There's a lot of inflatables, like an inflatable Santa, inflatable reindeer.
Yes, it's a peculiarly quiet scene. There is, you know, Christmas music playing in the background, but nobody around. It's deserted. So they say, okay, obviously this is suspicious. There's just a corpse that's up in the center of the road that is kind of mysteriously there. So of course they try driving forward through it and they are immediately laid upon by sniper fire. So they find some cover. They find that there are a couple of other soldiers of, again, unnamed affiliation that are kind of also in cover trying to determine the location of this rogue sniper who has taken a hideout in a nearby building. And we're essentially just, you know, more photographs are taken, more of the black and white vintage photography shots until the people who are laid in the Santa's village finally do take out the sniper.
Yeah, and I think there's one important dialogue beat in this scene, which is between Joel and one of the shooters who are on the ground shooting back at the person in a house far away, where I think he asks them what sides they're on or what are you doing? And the shooters on the ground say, what do you think we're doing? We're being shot at, so we're shooting back. And that seems to be, you know, this is like a very heavy-handed way of saying the sides don't matter. It's just that there's a lot of shooting on both sides, and that is bad. And if you don't want to get shot, you shouldn't be near us. And so that's what I got out of that scene.
I thought that was the most exciting part of the movie. I've also like definitely been to a lot of these Christmas markets. Like they do exist throughout the Midwest where they're like, right, we don't want you to have to walk around, so don't worry. And like for the other 10 months of the year, like this is just an empty field. I think that this got the point across that like people are simply just fighting each other. Maybe if we were gonna do like a 15-minute movie that was like war is bad, you could keep this and you could be like JCPenney will also be closed if you do this.
Yeah. I mean, I think another point that it was trying to make with this scene is like holidays don't matter anymore. Right. Like there's almost an implication that it is Christmas or it is the Christmas season, but no one knows because it's a civil war. And in civil war, folks, you better wear your Kevlar.
That's how it all got started. The war on Christmas went too
far.
I had to say happy holidays one too many times at Starbucks and suddenly, this is how it feels.
That's a more compelling backstory for the person who's, you know, pinned down inside the house. It's like, you say happy holidays one more time. Say
absolutely
it.
Yeah. So then I think things get even more intense. And we actually get to what was by far my favorite scene in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So a couple of their colleagues, by all accounts. So initially they're being followed on the road by seemingly a random car, and it's pulling up really close behind them, and it's kind of intense. It's like, is this one of the forces on one of the sides, like trying to clear the road? What's going on here? But it turns out to be two of their colleagues in journalism who want to play a funny game where they switch cars.
These are kind of stereotypical. These are the guys from Vice, you know. These are the guys who are we're journalists, but we're like hardcore about it, you know.
Yeah,
like,
we're edgy, man.
We like to play jokes. We like to prank each other.
We have beards.
We have tattoos.
Yeah, and so they pull up next to them and they do this car switch thing. It's very bizarre, honestly. But what ends up happening is that one of their two colleagues ends up in their car and Jesse goes in the colleague's car. And so now they're separated from Jesse, which is crucial because Jesse kind of functions as this, you know, younger person who they're trying to protect through the entire dangerous road trip. So there's a lot of suspense here. Where is Jesse? The car that Jesse's in, they drive really far ahead. And by the time the other members of our crew find them, they have been detained, and now it becomes, how do we rescue them from this detention?
Sammy That's says, right. Sammy sees what they're doing from afar, which is through the lens of Lee's camera or the viewfinder. We see none other than Jesse Plemons wearing these kind of wild rose colored or orange, like red orange sunglasses, spreading lie on a mass grave in this random field in the middle of middle America, filling up a grave, spreading lie on the corpses to make them decompose. Right. And Sammy essentially says, they, you know, if if you say that you are journalists, they are going to kill you because they don't want anyone to see what they're doing. So Sammy decides to stay behind. And that's kind of an important point.
Right. So Sammy, played by Stephen McKinley Henderson, stays back. The other three walk up and try to basically use their journalistic wiles to de-escalate whatever is going on in this detention of Jesse. And this is Bohai is the other one who's been detained at this point, right? And so they walk up and they immediately realize that the Jesse Plemons evil soldier with the evil sunglasses is not to be negotiated with. He's not going to be amenable to them saying they're journalists, to them trying to get their friends back, because Jesse Plemons immediately starts asking them, where are you from? You know, which is like a genuinely menacing question that a lot of people in America for a very long time have been getting. And so that's, to me, why this scene was in some ways the most powerful and suspenseful and meaningful. He starts asking them where they're from. He is happy with Lee's answer about where she's from. And then Joel, you know, who is South American, manages to convince Jesse Plemons that he's from Florida. But then Jesse Plemons gets to Tony, who is their Asian colleague, and asks him, where are you from? And Tony is extremely nervous. He's shaking. He can't get a word out. He's sobbing. And it's important to note that Jesse Plemons this entire time has a gun on them. And I believe before that, he shoots Bohai.
That's correct.
He shoots him point blank. So he shoots their other colleague, who had gone ahead with Jesse. And so he's got the gun trained on Tony, their Asian colleague, and asks him where he's from. Tony, he can't get a word out. Eventually, Tony says, Hong Kong. And Jesse Plemons says, Hong Kong? You mean China? And shoots him dead. And it's at that point that Sammy intervenes, right?
Yes. So we get Sammy, who, by the way, up to this point, it's made note that he is not super mobile. He walks with a cane. He's a little bit heavier set, and they make reference to this all throughout the movie. And, you know, he basically also says up to this point, well, I'll be useless if I'm out there with you because I can't move very fast. Sure enough, we get all of a sudden in the background, we see the White Press SUV speeding towards that mass grave, towards the militia members. Basically fishtails and, you know, hip checks with the car, Jesse Plemons and his other militia member colleague into the mass grave along with Jesse. And so now they actually have a chance to escape. In doing so, once they get everyone into the car, they start driving away. But of course, another militia member grabs some kind of, I guess, armor piercing rifle. And we later learn, you know, plugs one into the back of the car that actually does hit Sammy. It is revealed a couple of minutes later as they're driving along that he is wounded. They transfer him to the back seat. And I believe at this point, he essentially dies in the car on their way to their next checkpoint, correct?
Yeah, I think that is right. And so Stephen McKinley Henderson, in my opinion, best performance in the cast. He's out. And we still have like 30 to 40 more minutes in this movie. Damn it. And so, right. And so then they end up in the Western Forces military camp in Charlottesville. Of course, sad irony that this is actually the front in the war that Sammy most wanted to see. He doesn't get to see. I'm sure that's intentional. And then we learn another ironic fact, which is that at this point, DC, you know, the loyalist Union traditional American power has mostly surrendered to the rebels. So all of the rhetoric that Nick Offerman's character is putting out there, we didn't actually mention that the speech that he's giving at the beginning of the movie implies that the rebels are totally on the ropes, that America is going to win, that the Civil War is going to be lost by the rebels. But it turns out the rebels are basically completely rinsing and washing the loyalists. And basically DC has surrendered. And so the odds of Jesse, Joel, and Lee getting the kind of interview and photos that they wanted of the president are very low at this point.
It's right. Important here that Joel specifically says, as he is like getting drunk on a bottle of, I guess, straight vodka, it looks like, which, yeah. You know, again, it's just sort of like very stereotypical, like, I'm a guy, I'm getting drunk.
And I'm a bastard journalist.
Yes, I'm a bourbon bastard journalist. I'm getting drunk on straight alcohol.
The vodka had kind of more of an emotional journey and more character development than many of the people in this movie. Yes. It was there in every scene. They're hand in hand. Like, he'll just be in the background taking a swig at any point.
Absolutely.
It certainly provided more comfort to not only me, but I'm sure the other characters than most of the others were able to do to one another. But Joel specifically mentions here that Sammy has died for nothing. The fact that they are not going to be able to get their quote from the president, they're not going to be able to get the photograph of the president before they summarily execute him, is going to mean that Sammy has completely died in vain.
It's sort of like that Simpsons episode where they have fake IDs. And so Bart, Ralph, Milhouse, and Nelson is there too. And they rent a car to drive to the World's Fair. And then by the time they get there, all they have is like a wig store.
We're on the home stretch. Next stop, the Knoxville World's Fair and its fabulous Sun Sphere. We've only got 4 days to spend at the Wobber.
It's the 1986 World's Fair. I think it's in like 2002 that the episode came out.
Yes. And then, yes, so Sammy has died in vain. And a couple other things to note. Joel, this is just one of these aesthetic moments in the movie that really drove me crazy, where there's this incredibly dramatic, I think just music, no audio shot of Joel like wailing in pain and anguish about the fact that Sammy has died, which didn't work for me because it was unearned. Like because we know so little about the relationships or who these people are, it felt like a very discordant thing for Joel to like suddenly express this really intense emotion. And it just felt like one of those moments where like the sort of effort and striving of the director to be like, really give it your all, like scream and sob like your own child just died. You can feel that in how that scene was probably directed. And it feels like it's compensating for a lack of character development elsewhere. And then just one other note, we do meet two embedded journalists in this scene. So these are journalists who are following the rebel forces around, more or less functioning as kind of state media for the rebel forces and reporting on the Civil War from their perspective. And Joel sneers at them, like calls them all these embedded reporters. And so there's clearly like a distinction being set up between the kind of independent journalists that we've been following throughout this movie and these more embedded state media figures.
I don't know if you guys picked up on this and I just wasn't paying attention, but were they the road trip crew? Were they working for, well, Sammy was working for a rival newspaper.
Sammy was the New York Times. Joel, yes. And okay. Joel and Lee are working for Reuters, which they say to, right. Significantly, they say it to Jesse Plemons, and he says, that doesn't sound American.
Yes, that's right.
Which is, I mean, Reuters that's a funny is German,
line.
But
yeah, that's
but
a yes, funny line, actually.
It is a funny line. That was a good one.
Right. And so that's basically the end of the road trip part of the movie, because then we get to the big action set piece of the movie, which is the final siege of DC.
I have to say, at least from my perspective, I'll editorialize a little bit in the way that I present this, because to me, I mean, if you were looking for a war movie, the last half hour was really mostly what delivered what you were looking for. I mean, sure. This is where you get just percussive gunfire, explosions, helicopter chases, you know, yeah. Tracers flying through the air, jets flying, yeah. Tanks busting down concrete walls. Like, I mean, it's all here for the final scene. They really did go all out in trying to make this a kind of like dramatic war movie. So yes. We get Jesse, Lee, and Joel following. They are now acting as embedded reporters, following along yes. On basically the front line of the siege now. Jesse is in full form. She is out there just like snapping shots, you know, like putting herself in bodily harm's way, consistently having to get pulled back into cover by different soldiers. Lee, conspicuously, is basically having a PTSD episode and cannot take any photographs at all. And this was something that I also felt was sort of a little bit confusing and unearned. Like, I wasn't exactly yep. sure what led to this, but I don't know. Olivia, did you have thoughts on this?
I'm gonna defend this, because I think that it was, there can only be like one Jedi Master at a time, and Lee had lost her edge after the Jesse Plemons massacre. She should have just let all of her friends die if she was going to be a real journalist, but instead she kind of sacrificed them and then was sad about Sammy's death instead of being like, this isn't my duty as someone who takes pictures. So I think by then she had become too human by allowing like her guard to be let down in that way. And so like she had to die. And Jesse at that point is like, doesn't care if anyone lives or dies. So she is now like the new top dog.
I mean, it very easily could be a sort of like, you know, this revelation that like, oh my God, I have turned someone else into the unfeeling, you know, kind of stoic photography automaton that I am. What the fuck have I done? But also, I do think it's notable to, one thing that we forgot to mention is that when they are embedded in the Western Forces camp in the earlier scene, she has taken a photograph of Sammy dead or dying, and she conspicuously deletes it from yeah. her camera roll. Yes. And I mean, I think there was even a quip that was made earlier in the film where Jesse asks Lee, if I had died in that suicide bombing, would you have taken my photograph? Which again, I think is, we'll come back to this, what it means to be a spectator to death and violence when you know who the people are, when they have actually been humanized for you. But I thought that that was a conspicuous choice there as well.
Because I think by deleting the picture of Sammy instead of just like exploiting it for like, oh man, look how bad this war is, we're even killing journalists, that shows like she's lost her edge and she's not going to make it in the journalism world.
Yeah, that's certainly a choice. And I mean, like you are presaging here. So they eventually, you know, break through gates of, you know, Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. There's this fierce gun battle that takes place all through the West Wing. And it culminates in, you know, right as they are in the final hallway going up to the Oval Office, Jesse decides to jump out into the middle of the hallway to try and capture, you know, this perfect shot of a Secret Service member with some kind of fully automatic, like an Uzi or something like that, just coming around the corner to start opening fire. And she's right there in the middle of the hallway. Lee steps out, pushes her down, and then just gets, you know, plugged in the back, and she falls to the ground. Lee has died. She has given her life protecting this new young hotshot photojournalist.
Right. And then Basically, we get the final action set piece in the Oval Office where they continue. So, like, Lee is dead. That's it. They just sort of, just continue following the Western
Pretty
forces.
unceremonious,
Pretty
honestly, that the main
unceremonious.
character has just died.
Yeah. They continue following the Western forces into the Oval Office. And at that point, they're about to kill the president. And Joel asks the president for a quote. He doesn't actually give him a quote. He says, "Please don't let them kill me." Joel says, "That'll do." And then the president is shot, and Jesse photographs it, and the movie ends. And, the final shot of the movie is Jesse's photograph of the Western forces standing with the president's dead body.
Just, again, this is what's giving big Abu Ghraib vibes at the end of this, is that they are just grimacing like freaks around the dead body of this, president that they have just summarily executed. And and that's really the kind of the shot that the movie fades out on.
Right. So two questions I want us to think about here. We've kind of gone through the entire movie. I think we've analyzed as we've gone, but there's two questions that really stick with me about this movie. One is, how do we read the politics of this movie, and what critiques do we have of the politics of this movie, particularly in this moment with everything going on, with from everything from the war in Gaza to right-wing fascism on the rise around the world, to various laws and surveillance policies targeting journalists around the world, and then specifically the role of journalism and photography and visual rhetoric in this movie?
I can start because I think I have an answer that kind of synthesizes both of those. So, I mean, my thoughts on the politics, when I first walked out of the movie, my initial reaction was everybody who is crapping on this movie is missing the point, that it is not actually intending to be a movie about politics in America in insert current year, in 2024, or the kind of like, it's not meant to be, I would think, a cautionary tale about what brings us to the brink of a civil war, but more so a reflection on what it means to be a spectator to violence, and particularly like what it would mean for the thing that we Americans have become so inured to post 9/11 over the last 20 or so years, which is just witnessing violence on social media, on the news, on just every day. Every day we're getting just violence, violence, violence,
And
death, death, death
also
everywhere.
post Columbine, like mass
Yes.
shootings as well.
Yes, 100%. And I mean, I sought out some other scholarship on this because I was interested in just like kind of synthesizing a couple of other perspectives. I'll be brief here in saying the first one was Lili Chuliraki on the effects of what she calls the sublime regime of pity, the way that through journalism, we tend to aestheticize the horror of war by erasing the identities of sufferers and perpetrators alike. As a result, it is more about the sort of staging of human misfortune as a kind of aesthetic object. Which, upon further reflection, I think is really what this movie is. It is not nece I don't think it's right to still read it as a political movie because, A, I don't think it's meant to be that way. B, I think the politics of its maker are pretty blinkered, which we can get into. But also, I mean, I think just moreover, it is meant to be a kind of aestheticization of what it means to be a spectator to violence, particularly when it comes to the home front. My thought on that was that, you as a spectator are supposed to be the person reflecting on your position as somebody who would be pretending that it isn't happening, who would be watching it on the news, scrolling past it on social media, but you would be going to your job at the boutique the next day, selling frontier cottagecore chic to other hipsters, right? Like that's, to me, that was my kind of reading of the film, but I also, upon further reflection, which we'll get into, I think I was doing what Olivia was saying, which was I was envisioning a better movie than what was actually intended. So.
Well, I agree. I listened to the Big Picture podcast interview with Alex Garland, and I think that me and Alex had different ideas about what this movie was about.
You and Alex Garland, or you and Alex
Yeah.
Helberg?
No, me and Alex Garland have
Oh,
different
okay.
opinions
Yeah.
about this
You're on a
movie.
first name basis with that Alex as well. Okay, cool.
Yes.
Yeah, nice.
So, I agree with Alex Helberg that I think that we are supposed to wonder who we are in this movie. Like, are we the people in the boutique who are ignoring violence in the world? Or Are we, journalists who are just watching everything and dehumanized towards it? I always think movies about observation are interesting because we're just watching other people watch other people. So I don't know, something Foucauldian about that, I guess.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I agree that that aspect of observation is interesting. I think it's been done better in other movies, like, for instance, Funny Games, which is a Michael Haneke movie that I highly, highly recommend, is all about sort of how media portrays violence and makes us complicit in it almost through its distanciation. And that's really, for me, aesthetically, what rubs me the wrong way about this movie so much is how the violence depicted within it, not just depicted by the journalists, but actually depicted by the film, is at once extremely graphic and shocking and traumatizing and extremely unreal. I mean, it almost feels like we, for an AI video generator, like, gave it a prompt, like, create a gritty war movie set in America. This is what I imagine it would look like and feel like, because it would be extremely graphic, but it would also feel sort of like a video game, like something that it doesn't actually matter and has no real substance to it. And so that was kind of my subjective experience of the movie. But the other thing I would say is that, moving a little bit to the politics of the movie, I do think that one of the things that I've benefited the most from scholars like Dana Cloud and even Robin Reams, who we've had on a recent episode, is thinking about the importance of narrative for getting people to understand politics and getting people to believe in a political message. And I do think, if we read a little bit more broadly and look at, like, Alex Garland's interview on Pod Save America, where he mentioned that really the Black Lives Matter protests in summer 2020 made him realize that he's not left wing. It turned.
Amazing, just astonishingly bad interview. Sorry, we'll dub in
Yeah.
some audio of it
We'll
here,
dub
no
in some
doubt,
audio
but
from that, but it turned him against the left and made him realize he's a centrist. It made him realize that he has more in common with the center right.
one of my realizations in summer of 2020 is that I would always have described myself for years and years and years as left wing. If somebody said, "What are you?" I'd have said left wing. And in some respects, in ideological terms, I could be really very left wing in on particular issues, I suppose. And around that time, I realized I'm not left wing, I'm centrist. That is to say, I'm left of center. And it was the word centrist and the way I felt attached to the concept of centrism, and suddenly having a kind of epiphany about it in a way, and realizing that I had framed politics as left-right, and I no longer in a way cared about left-right. I do care about left-right on some ideological issues of the function of running a country, like how taxes are spent or something like that. But I don't care about left-right when the issue is centrism versus extremism. And at that point, I'm a centrist, and I have far, far more in common with someone on the center right than I do on an extreme. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
And when we think about, he's very dismissive of critiques of the free market in that interview. He just basically takes a stance that politics really is a contest between centrism and extremism, rather than between actual forces in society like capital and labor, or, white supremacy and everyone who is not viewed or socially constituted as white. These forces that I think are much more informative about what's going on in politics. He sees it as, like, normalcy versus extremism. And that just strikes me as so ahistorical that, when you look at what the movie is saying to me, is that this kind of violence breaks out when we allow our politics to become too extreme. And Garland, in that interview, strongly implies that he views these journalists as heroes.
That they do great work if they do it in an ideological way, which is to be nonpartisan, or put another way, impartial. I think that's good for news reporters to be impartial. lack of impartiality I would attach to the social media thing we were talking about before. I think it's problematic with reporters. And the other thing is they can be incredibly brave. So what's not to admire in that, I would say.
Yeah.
And what I see them doing is just walking around often in a very supportive way with the rebel forces, at least to the extent that they're offering no critiques. The rebel forces are actually helping them move through these violent scenes in a way that feels somewhat not impartial. And they're documenting and photographing what's happening, but not providing any broader narrative or context that could actually help inform people about what's going on. And I think that's what good journalism does, is it should provide a context and a meaning to something instead of just these fragments of images of what's going on. And it seems to me that Garland thinks that pure images of what's going on with no commentary, no context, no narrative, will actually provide a more objective basis for us to make decisions and perhaps avoid extremism. But ultimately, yeah, these did not feel like real people to me, the journalists or the people involved in the war, because there's so little world building and honestly, even dialogue to like learn who the people are in this movie.
Well, that led to one of my biggest questions about this movie is why on earth in like the year of our Lord 2024, are these people photographers and not taking videos of anything? They're like,
such a good
here's
question.
My black and white camera. Let me develop some film. You're just creating art about the war. You're not like, you're not reporting things. You're just like capturing aesthetic images where they're like, oh, I see a really creepy dead body. Let's all pull over and take a picture of it.
Right.
The good folks at Reuters are going to love this. Like, they're not really doing any research. They're not really writing anything. They're not interviewing people. They're just looking for sort of aesthetic shots of violence to be like, war is bad. Look at this like skull on the side of the road in front of Santa's workshop. Like, do you really want this to happen?
No, and I think you're absolutely right that my guess for why that choice was made is that it was a purely aesthetic choice. It would look better and be more interesting as a movie for them to be taking still photos so that those could be edited, you know, throughout the film. And it just made the film look and feel better as an experience for the viewer. But I mean, I think that gets at the point as well, that there are a lot of choices being made here to avoid telling a story and telling a true and believable story. I mean, the stuff that happens in this movie is ridiculously implausible. The fact that I saw someone, I think it was Tom Sexton from the Trillbillies, pointed out that like the fact that they would respect your press credentials and be like, yeah, just like calmly stewarding you through the Oval Office. Like, it's honestly, if this were sort of a realistic portrayal of the world of the movie, they should have probably died in the first 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes.
Frankly, it's just un-American to think like this. To think that if there were a civil war, people would be like, oh, excuse me, sir, please take a photograph of my mass grave.
Exactly.
I don't see this happening.
Exactly. No, and so, yeah, I just wanted to add that you're totally right that it feels like they're more interested in, yeah, like creating art about the war than actually informing people about the war, which is what journalism should do. And that's what I find so confusing about these interviews with Alex Garland, where he says that journalists should be impartial, they're heroic, they inform us about what's going on, but they're not informing anyone about what's going on. We also get no sense that there's a public sphere that these photos would actually go into and help inform debates. So that was also confusing to me.
Well, as they're leaving the creepy dress shop, Lee is telling Jesse, like, oh, my parents just live on a farm and they're pretending like this isn't happening. They're not participating in this war. And that's why it's our job to take pictures. They're not really convincing anyone to join this war. Neither are they participating in the war. I don't see how they're that much better off than people who are just living on farms, not doing anything.
Not only that, Olivia, but the other part of that quote in that scene is that Kirsten Dunst, Glee's character's kind of commentary on their role is, we're just here to take pictures. We photograph so that other people can ask questions. And that, to me, is, it's a tell of the way that Alex Garland kind of views the media as this kind of like neutral arbiter of facts, and not some, as an entity with extraordinary power to sequence those facts in a narratively compelling way. I think that by pretending that it's not, you allow, I mean, just everything that every scholar since the beginning of the war on terror, and even before that, has been warning us about the role of the press in just like normalizing violence and imperialism specifically, like just... Yes. There's so much different that journalism could be doing, but we are constantly force-fed this message that by just photographing dead bodies and, you know, relaying them so that people can make their own decisions on the basis of it. Like, they don't have, most people don't have the fucking context to understand that stuff. Like, they do need a story told. They do.
Yeah, you have to tell them who shot that person and why and what was the broader situation and what policies could maybe ameliorate that situation.
Right. Well, because if you're reporting to me like dead bodies are bad, shooting people is bad, then what's so wrong about me living on a farm not participating in this war if the message is like we shouldn't be participating in a war? I don't know.
Which is, I think you're really getting at, Olivia, the secret smart thing that this movie actually did convey. If there's any good thing that I could say about it, it does really do a good job of portraying what most Americans would probably react like when a civil war pops off. You're not going to be the one on the front lines. You are going to be the person doom scrolling through all of the images of it and trying to say, you know, actually, I'm just going to go garden and pretend it's not happening.
But I also think that undermines the world of the film.
Absolutely.
Because of the fact that I think you're totally right, Alex, that's why this is so implausible. This won't happen in America. Like,
there won't be enough for the Western forces to make them up. They're mostly TV watchers.
The Western
forces
are all going to be scrolling.
We're going to be buying large 5-gallon buckets of macaroni and cheese and putting it in our basements. We do not have time for this nonsense.
Yeah, just like Robin Reams' father, another reference to a recent episode.
Silver nitrate pills, you know,
No, that's the thing. They're all isolated, atomized individuals. That's why militia politics typically don't work in the U.S. is because you cannot, not only can you not get enough of them to agree on one thing, but they can't form coalitions with one another because they're all TV watchers. They're all, sorry, I'm going a little hard on this point.
No.
I mean, I think it's an important one to make that really kind of undercuts the ethos of this movie.
And I think that's where the political critique, you know, to the extent that you can read one, and I think there is one in this movie, the political critique of it falls so short and feels so kind of, not to generationally stereotype, but like boomer brain, New York Times centrist brain, where there's always this specter of like, oh, there are protests, there's going to be a civil war, you know, the far left and the far right are so extreme, a civil war could happen at any time. And it's like, first of all, that's extremely ahistorical. Like, we have always had protests. We've always had people with extreme opinions. Honestly, this is a very mild point in our history in terms of extreme protests specifically. So the fact that Alex Garland developed his politics out of the 2020 protests is a big tell, that he thought that that was some kind of like unprecedented, horrible, horrifying moment for America. But yeah, it's like this stuff happens. And people go back to watching Ted Lasso while scrolling Instagram. Like this is not a world where this kind of thing could take place. And I think that's what rings so false about it to me. And just to come back to the aesthetic, the reason that I made drive one of my two verbs, this movie just looks like a car commercial to me. Like, can we just say, like, it looks like a Volkswagen commercial. There's even like a really corny, cheesy, I think it's like a Sturgill Simpson song, who I like, but there's just like a country music montage in the middle where they're just driving and there's sort of like flames and sparks. And it all felt so distanced and abstracted and fake to me.
I had no idea how to feel during that scene because Sammy is dying. there's like a forest fire and they're driving through the night and they're like, we like clearly Sammy is just going to die in this car because they have nowhere to go. And are we supposed to feel sort of like nostalgic? The music, the like sparks flying, the gentle breeze.
It was a big Garden State moment in the movie. Like it felt like suddenly I was watching Garden State or like a romantic comedy or something.
I feel like this is, I mean, I will just go ahead and go on the record saying that is when I took my bathroom break in the middle of the movie. This is when I walked out of the theater and it was like, because I thought I was like, oh, this is a car commercial in the middle of this movie. It's ad break time. And of course I missed Sammy kicking the bucket in the car. So, I mean, my bad, I guess, but also Alex Garland, shame on you for making it, placing native advertising in your movie.
But I did want to say, Alex Helberg, that I really like your version of the movie. And I think that the only, and that's what I was struggling with, like right after I got out of the movie, because there were definitely things I liked about it. I found it compelling. I found it suspenseful. I thought Stephen McKinley Henderson was fantastic in it. I thought Kirsten Dunst was great. The other two leads I was not as crazy about, but I think the only way this movie works is if it's like a Martin Scorsese film where the characters are actually supposed to be bad people.
Yes.
And you become, or even like something like Breaking Bad, which I know Olivia loves, like where they're actually anti-heroes and you're supposed to be kind of compelled by how grotesque they are, that they have no opinion about any of this stuff. They're just sort of taking art shots of horrible violence, of their country literally falling apart.
Oh, I thought that's what we were supposed to think of this movie. Like, wow, look at these awful people. They're like, I thought the whole movie was about the dehumanization of these journalists who all they care about is chasing the perfect shot until they're like a kind of a husk of a man like Joel, where all he cares about is like the adrenaline rush, or Kirsten Dunst, who's like sort of jaded and dead inside. And the moment she allows any amount of emotion into her life, she dies because of it.
Yeah. And I think that version is better, but I really don't think that's the version that was intended, in part because like the movie is also like the perspective of the film is similarly dead inside. And then just two final questions I have about this movie, just to leave the listeners with. One is, you know, what are the social effects of a movie like this coming out at a time when so many Palestinian journalists are being killed? Because again, it makes these journalists look like shit. It makes them seem like people who just observe things, embed with military forces, and have no real critique or sense of morality about what they're doing. But there are journalists in Gaza who are desperately trying to tell the story of how their basically entire worlds are being destroyed right now, and they're being killed for it. They're being targeted by the IDF. And I just worry that it sends a message. I have plenty of critiques of journalism and especially of mainstream journalism, but it sends a message that war journalists are like these amoral people. And I think the best war journalists actually care deeply about the wars they're covering and usually have a specific critique of the wars they're covering. Like Palestinian journalists are not just putting these images out because they're, you know, well-crafted or well-composed images. They're putting them out with the statement, this is what's happening to us. You need to change your policies to stop this from happening to us. So there's no sort of neutrality when it comes to good war journalism, in my opinion. And then the second thing is, I'm very curious if we might be able to research or find out if there was military cooperation in the making of this movie. You may recall our interview with Roger Stahl last year, where we talked about his documentary Theaters of War. The vast majority of American films that use military equipment have some kind of partnership with the U.S. military. Now, it could be that they found, you know, A24 indie style workarounds for this and didn't have to actually lease equipment, but a lot of it looked pretty realistic to me. So I'm very curious if some of the abstracted, featureless aspects of the script were requirements of the military to use their stuff.
Great questions all, I think. The one thing that I'll just really quickly point out about what does this say about journalism in the age of the genocide happening in Gaza, which is to say that, like, I mean, right now, as we are recording this, the main media attention right now is being pointed at Ivy League universities in the US, like at Columbia, like at NYU and other places, many other, like over 20, I think now, that have solidarity encampments where students are literally calling on their universities to divest materially from the companies that are contributing weaponry or other kinds of resources to the IDF or to other sort of proxies that are perpetrating this conflict, and are doing so in a way that I think, you know, they are getting kind of hounded by other journalists stateside who are not doing a very good job of covering it, saying that it's all about anti-Semitism on college campuses, despite the fact that Jewish students are overrepresented among those who are protesting in solidarity with Palestine. At the same time, the more inspiring thing here is that we are seeing at least, you know, not a generation of media consumer boomers who are just eating this up, but actually what we're witnessing right now that I take some heart in reflecting on this movie is activists who are incredibly media savvy, who are actually making a lot of very smart choices in how they present themselves to the media to kind of counteract those narratives. But that's just something that I was kind of thinking about as we wrap up.
All right, Olivia, final thoughts.
As I began watching this, and we see sort of Kirsten Dunst's backstory covering wars outside of the U.S., to me it felt like sort of a, well, like, why are we concerned about a hypothetical civil war that is not happening in the United States when there's, like, actual civil wars going on in other places in the world, but we're not really concerned about how journalism is covered there? That was something that I kind of thought we were going to get into more, is comparing a hypothetical U.S. civil war to maybe generate more thought on global politics. But I don't know that it really got into that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that we could cover when it comes to this movie, but I am happy with some of the threads that we've pulled out here. And I definitely came away from chatting with both of you with, you know, a more nuanced opinion of the movie, not just thinking it's a shitty car commercial, which I still kind of think, but
that's fair.
But thank you all for tuning in to our first edition of Real Verb. We will be back with more movie-centric episodes soon. And yeah, anything else to add, my friends?
Go out and buy a Volkswagen. That's my last
Alex word. Garland will thank you.
Yes.
And I'm going to be getting in contact with Scorsese to make Civil War 2 the good version. If any of you are interested, hopefully we should have that by the time the next episode comes out.
Yeah, Marty really will be an official Reverb editorial team member soon. So thank you all for tuning in, and we will be back with more Reverb content soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Our show today was produced by Alex Helberg, Calvin Pollock, and Olivia Burnett, with editing work by Calvin. Reverb's co-producers at large are Ben Williams and Sophie Wadzak. You can subscribe to Reverb and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out our website at www.reverbcast.com. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ReverbCast. That's REVERB_CAST. If you've enjoyed our show and want to help amplify more of our public scholarship work, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice and tell a friend about us. We sincerely appreciate the support of our listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in.